Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Mullen, joined by John Roering, Craig Mauger, Emily Lawler, and Yanji Wong. A little later, we're going to be talking to Josh Pugh to get an update what happened at the Michigan Democratic Party Central State Committee this past weekend. And also, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is going to talk about the personal property tax package that's going through the legislature right now. First, though, big news this past week, Debbie Dingell is going to be running for that seat. And it looks like there's going to be a little bit of a showdown, Craig, with possibly Rebecca Warren. It's looking pretty good, like she's going to run. What do you put the odds of on her getting in at?
I would say the odds are pretty high. I would say it's a 90% chance she's going to get in. I mean, basically, she says she's going to make a decision officially within about a week. And it seems like all the people who have some knowledge of her thinking are planning on her running. And if she chooses to run, a lot of dominoes are going to fall. People in the House might be running for her seat. People will have to run for the House seats that will become available. So, I mean, a lot of people will be awaiting this decision. There's going to be a lot of pressure on her to make it very quickly.
Jen, she doesn't really have... Is now a good time for her to run? She could run again for the Senate, be in a position to be in leadership in the Senate Democratic Caucus. Is this a good idea?
I think it's... Well, if she's interested in Congress, this is the opportunity, because while Debbie Dingell will be a very strong candidate, I really think, you know, given the tenure of the Dingell time in that seat, you could make a decent campaign over the fact that it's time for a change, that it's time for the Dingell era to end, that this seat is not a family heirloom, but it's for the people to pick who's going to sit in that seat.
This would make a pretty interesting showdown here, Emily, where you've got two Democratic women going for an open seat, assuming they're the only two in. That would be very interesting. I don't think we've seen that in politics in this state.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be interesting because they're both such strong candidates and not unknown quantities in that district. They've got a lot of ground to cover, but I think that it could be a really interesting competition. So.
I think for Rebecca Warren, I don't know if there's really anything to lose on this. You know, in the best case scenario, from what we've seen from the Senate Democratic Caucus, they're maybe looking at a pickup of three seats. I think if they pick up three seats, they're going to be ecstatic to get at 15. So that would mean that you're still Senate minority leader,
yeah,
you know,
even if she is in leadership, she'll be leading a minority caucus.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's not necessarily all that enticing. And if you want to advance your political career, it would seem like this is a great opportunity to do that. It seems like she's got a lot of connections if she wants to go in that direction. The minimum wage, the Michigan Democratic Party's Central Committee endorsed that over the weekend. It looks like they're going to embrace this, John, that they're going to try and go ahead and push this ballot proposal. Maybe if they just focus on one instead of three, four, it will be of some benefit to them.
It could, but again, you've got to go back, and there's still not a lot of evidence that these ballot proposals actually make a difference in terms of who turns out.
Right. There is no proof.
There is no proof. There's anecdotes, but it's going to be an interesting debate to watch the business community react and what kind of campaign against are they going to come up with. And by going against it, are you doing more damage to your own cause than advancing it?
Emily, I just think this is a winner for Democrats. Just the polling looks good. People just in general are supportive of giving more to people who are not making all that much. I think there's a sympathetic argument to be made. Quite frankly, I don't see this really hurting them.
You know, I think that some interesting messaging is going to be from local businesses. I think if business groups and restaurant groups can get, you know, Dusty's Diner around the corner to say that this is going to shut us down, you won't be able to have your Sunday pancake breakfast here if you vote for this proposal, that messaging could go either way on this.
Or you could say that the price of your pancakes are going to go up a buck or two. Do you think that's going to have much of an impact, Craig? Are people sympathetic to saying, geez, I don't know if I want to pay that much more for my meal here at this restaurant?
I think people are sympathetic to that argument. I think the issue is this is one of those things where people are pretty dead set in their opinion on this. I mean, you're either for it or against it, so I don't know how much wiggle room there is to really sway opinion on it. But another interesting element is how much money is the business community going to have to pour into fighting this, and is that going to keep money out of the campaign coffers of some candidates?
Rasmussen actually had a poll, I think it was last week, that showed support for minimum wage falls below passage if you bring in the job loss question. So in other words, do you support a minimum wage? More people do than not, but do you support a minimum wage if it costs jobs? And then the support drops off dramatically. So there is an argument there that obviously has a resonance with voters, and it'll be interesting to see how the business community crafts that in Michigan.
I think in Florida, I was told that when they put this on the ballot, the business community outspent supporters of this somewhat like 10 to 1 and still got passed. So you could make the argument that the business community is going to have to spend a lot more to get this thing defeated. If it gets on the ballot, then supporters are going to have to. And that's the question, too. I mean, I think that there's going to be a big effort here now to challenge signatures. Once they get the signatures, try and defeat it maybe on the wording. Maybe they did something technically wrong, and try and stop it that way so you don't have to fight this expensive battle later. Join us now to give us an update on what happened this past weekend. This is Josh Pugh. Joining us on the program now, Josh Pugh, the spokesperson for the Michigan Democratic Party. Josh, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
Anytime, Kyle.
All right, so the State Central Committee for the Democratic Party met this weekend. Give us a rundown on what happened.
The Central Committee took a vote on drawing up a resolution to be sent to the policy committee to endorse the ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage, which essentially means we took the first step towards endorsing the minimum wage. It was in Canton in the 11th Congressional District, so a lot happening down there in Southeast Michigan this year in 2014. A lot of candidates, Diane Slavin's running for state senate against Pat Kolbeck, Christy Pagan and Natalie Mosher running for that 21st State House seat, and then also obviously the 11th Congressional District, Bobby McKenzie and Neil Kumar. A very exciting primary on the Republican side over there, too. So
tell me, how many people are on this State Central Committee? Who are we talking about?
Over 100, and the way it's broken down is by congressional district. So really party activists from all over the place. DNC members sit on it. Executive committee members are invited to attend. And then, as with all of our Democratic Party meetings, it's open to the public. So a lot of party activists who don't necessarily have a vote on the committee come to sit in on the caucuses, to watch the business, to hear from the chair, get a quarterly update on what the party's doing and our efforts to win in 2014.
So the vote to support this resolution on minimum wage, was this unanimous?
It was unanimous, that's right. And again, I mean, I ran through the particulars of what it means from a process standpoint, but I think we have a real consensus in the Democratic Party that, you know, what really matters and what's really important is that we've got families all over the state who are working full-time jobs, working to raise a family, and yet they're living in poverty, and that's just wrong. And we've got a governor and a legislature here in Lansing that have the opportunity to do this whenever they want. You know, the last time it happened, it was with votes from Republicans and with actually a Republican majority in one of the houses, if I'm not mistaken, voted to raise the minimum wage. And it happened at the federal level, too. You know, Republicans came together and it was signed, but the last minimum wage increase was signed by a Republican president. So it's really striking that the Republican Party in 2014 is so unanimously against this. But I think what we learned this weekend and what I've seen again and again is that Democrats are completely behind this idea of giving families a raise by increasing the minimum wage.
These ballot proposals were not successful for the Democratic cause in 2012. Is there a concern that we could bog down the ballot again and create some kind of problems on that front?
I mean, look, there are a lot of issues going on in Lansing every day. A lot of different constituencies, not just in the Democratic Party, but independent voters all over the state are very concerned and very upset with what they've seen at Lansing. And, you know, what this governor and this legislature have done, this agenda that they've implemented, it's just not working. And you saw that with the proposal to turn back the emergency manager law. The only time any of the laws signed by this governor and passed by this legislature have made it to the ballot, they've been resoundingly rejected by the people. We've seen a strong signal from people all over the state that look, they just have the wrong agenda. And again, the legislature and the governor have an opportunity to stand up and take action on this, and they're not doing it, and we should expect them to be frustrated by that. And so I think you're going to see a strong show of support at the grassroots level from all over the state, just of people standing up and saying, look, this is just wrong. We need to stand up and give these families and give these people a raise.
So you think this will drive people to the ballot?
Look, I mean, people have all kinds of motivations to get out and vote, and they're going to in November 2014. I think as Democrats, we are united behind our candidates at the top of the ticket. We're completely behind this effort to increase the minimum wage, and I think you're going to see a strong turnout in November 2014.
Debbie Dingell was at this State Central Committee as well. What did she have to tell committee members?
Mrs. Dingell gave a great speech about the need to come together as Democrats to vote out Governor Snyder, and also to send Gary Peters to the U.S. Senate. As you've heard Mr. Dingell say over the last week, Congress is broken right now, and we have a real situation in Lansing and in Washington where the agenda and the things that we're seeing come out of the Republican Party is just completely wrong and completely out of step and out of touch with what voters want. And Mrs. Dingell is a really strong candidate for that congressional seat. But we're blessed as Democrats to have a really strong stable of candidates in Southeast Michigan, very, very qualified lawmakers. And regardless of what happens, I'm sure that voters are going to come out in the 12th district in November, and they're going to send a Democrat to Congress to represent them and to fight for middle-class families.
Did she just show up, or was she invited? Or?
Well, she sits in the DNC.
She's
invited,
okay,
and as I said, you know, they're completely open to the public. It's not unusual to see candidates show up.
Okay.
To these events.
And this was not an endorsement. The Democrats didn't endorse anyone in this particular.
Again, we welcome all of our candidates to come up. Diane Slavens, who's running for the Senate, was there. Christy Pagan, Natalie Mosher running for that 21st House seat. I saw Bobby McKenzie and Dr. Kumar running for that 11th congressional seat, which is actually where the meeting was held.
Yeah.
And then we had, you know, candidates running for seats at all levels. I spoke to a gentleman running for Senate over on the west side of the state. We got folks from the UP that actually make the drive down. It's a really exciting chance to talk to folks who, you know, we don't always see on a regular basis.
This morning we had a press conference that you guys hosted here regarding Terry Land's record on auto bailout. A very interesting take. Tell us why you think that's important for voters to know.
The auto rescue was very successful, and the auto industry has come roaring back. The big three are doing better than they have in decades. You know, even the car and truck of the year here, the Silverado made in Flint, Michigan. GM swept that, the first sweep for a major automaker in a few years there. And look, we saw in 2012 with Mitt Romney trying to whitewash his record, and I have no doubt that we'll see it again in 2014 with Terry Land. They've just proven again and again that their agenda is anti-middle class, and it's just completely out of step with what the voters of Michigan want.
Very good. Josh Pugh, the spokesperson for the Michigan Democratic Party. Josh, thanks for making it to MERS World Headquarters. Great to see you.
Thanks a lot, Kyle. It was quite the trek, but I made it over. So
those five blocks can be very dangerous.
That's right.
Joining me now on the podcast, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. Lieutenant Governor, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
Pleasure to be with you.
You know, it was funny watching you walk across the street today after that polar plunge wrapped in a blanket. You had to be a little cold. That was 7 degrees out there.
It was remarkably cold. I mean, even just being out in the air was cold. Of course, jumping in the water that much more and walking across the street. But it was for a great cause. Special Olympics has been a spectacular partner in a lot of issues that I care deeply about, and so I'm happy to be a part of the movement.
You didn't dress in Superman or Batman or anything like that?
No, you know, I look at it like jumping in the water is crazy enough, I'll go ahead and wear shorts.
Well, very good. The big story this week here from the legislative standpoint was the introduction of these bills to change some aspects of the PPT revenue replacement mechanism. Tell me why you decided to revisit this issue, because obviously when the PPT was phased out, to be scheduled to be phased off, those bills passed in 2012, you didn't have to revisit the subject again, but you were open to talking about making revisions. Why?
I was committed right from the very beginning in trying to find consensus in a way that, you know, everybody seemed to agree that type of taxation was bad. It was not the right direction for the future of our state. It was old and antiquated, and yet there was some difficulty in coming to what the right solution was to that. And I believed then, and I believe now, and I think this package is proving it right, that there was consensus to be found. And so as we continued to work over the different issues, we were able to bring all the different parties to the table that have a stake in this and find a way to take care of local government, and I think long-term really improve the position local government stands in, while modernizing and making our tax system more competitive.
Was there a concern that if you didn't make these changes that we could go through this election in August, the ballot proposal would fail, the PPT phase out then would fail as well, and all the work that you've done would have gone for naught?
I'm always concerned about, you know, open questions when it comes to policy changes, and so getting a ballot initiative passed will be that lift. It's always a heavy lift, no matter what. But I'm very, very pleased to now be in a position to where we can tell the story about why it's important for it to pass and have local government and businesses singing from the same choir book. You know, everybody agreeing that this is the right direction.
This is a kind of a complex change that you're making. In short, what we're doing is instead of using PPT revenue, we're going to use the use tax and have that backfilled by expiring tax credits. But how do you say this to the average voter out there so they don't just get lost in the minutia of it all?
There's only one aspect of the plan that that the voters have to approve, and that is to move the use tax from state ownership over to local government. And so we're going to be asking the people of the state of Michigan, would you like for this for the use tax to be split between state and local government going forward to support those local government services. The other aspects of the plan, I think it'll be important that we talk about it and say that we're doing this to become more more competitive. This is benefiting small businesses all the way through to some of the very large ones, but then also creating a more stable revenue source for local government. If you look at the personal property tax, the way it's performed since 1999, it has declined as a percent of the entire tax base, the entire property tax base, by 39%. And so when you consider that, and the fact that so many of these of the new investments come with abatements anyway, it's not a very good source long-term for local government to rely on. Use tax, on the other hand, has been a very consistent performer.
So this is a more stable revenue source, you can say, to the voters for local government.
That's right. This will be something that provides more assurance long-term for local government, who provides some of the services that people care most about, like police services, fire services, ambulatory services. These are the sorts of things that I think people place the highest value on, and it's why we consider them to be essential services in this reimbursement package. And when we're able to put something on the table that presents a better long-term outcome for those types of government functions, I think people will respond well, particularly when you combine that with a better environment for job growth.
Has there been any concerns brought up on these 10 bills?
The major players at the table seem satisfied right now, and so I'm cautiously optimistic that what we saw in the Senate will play its way through committee as we go through the rest of the process. I'm always open to talking to people about it. You know, really, it's the state itself, the state government operation. I think that I need to go back now and do a little bit of work for the stakeholders that rely on state government revenue to show that the way this plan, even though we're dedicating some state revenue to local government going forward, that we can do so in a way that we have planned for in our budget process. We do have the expiring credits, and it won't negatively impact the ability of the state to do what it does today. I kind of took for granted, or I have taken for granted, that people understand that we're going to support local government and it will not negatively impact the ability of the state government to do the things that it does today, but I'd like to go back and reinforce that message now with some of the stakeholders there, just to be proactive.
Because this isn't going to be mystery money here. You've got it earmarked. We've got a source of revenue to replace this. How much are we talking about annually for the state?
Basically, when you fully fund in the plan. This plan here, this compromise, will dedicate about $75 or $76 million more for local government over what the 2012 package dedicated. So that's the increase, if you will, that we're dedicating and that we have, you know, worked into our budget assumptions.
Why did you guys do a 100% reimbursement right off the bat?
I'm very determined to make decisions and promises that I know for a fact can be kept, and not to leave any guesswork. And so until we could identify all of the revenue sources and how it would come together and show that it did fit into the state's long-term fiscal plans, we didn't want to go any further than we did in 2012. But now that we have a better picture of how things are trending, we feel much more comfortable going the rest of the way to 100%, and then also changing the delivery mechanism to local government to a way that they feel more comfortable as well.
Changing gears here a little bit, looking forward here also 2014, you're going to have a challenge at the convention here, it looks like, from some Tea Party challenger. Overall, do you think that the Tea Parties are going to live up to a threat here, and if you get renominated, as we would expect you would be, that they're going to sit out and that's going to damage the entire ticket, Snyder, Cal, all the way down?
The governor and this administration have very strong support from Tea Party voters. Keep in mind, there are Tea Party organizations that carry that name, but they don't represent all Tea Party voters. That when people went to the polls in 2010 and were a big part, Tea Party voters, a big part of sending the governor and I to this office, they were concerned about things like debt. We've reduced debt. They're concerned about the overreach of government and the regulatory agencies. We've reduced regulations by a net 1,500 rules and regs since the governor took office, and not to mention the type of job growth and the fiscal improvement of the state. It's true that we don't agree on everything, but the agenda that we pursued, I think, is one that freedom-loving individuals can really get behind. I believe that those folks in 2009 and 2010 that were part of that Tea Party movement, the Tea Party voters, that we will receive strong support from them. And I will go a little further to say that I personally have a lot of support from Tea Party voters. And I will readily acknowledge that there are some people that are unhappy with some of the things that we've done in the administration. But this is a big family, and we're not going to always agree on every single thing. And I do not expect that there will be widely practiced sitting out of the next election by conservative voters, because the governor's record is indeed conservative, but more important than that, it's effective. And that's really what is driving families today to be more optimistic about the outlook of Michigan. And we see that happening now. You remember how people looked at, do you have a negative outlook or of Michigan's future, or positive? It's always been upside down, but we're starting to see that change now. And that's about results, and I think that's what this next election will be about.
Very good. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, thanks for the time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kyle.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Special thanks to the crew here, Josh Pugh, and also special thanks to Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. This is another sad edition of MERS Monday, though, because one of us will be leaving. Yanji Wong is going to be taking off and going back across the Pacific Ocean. Yanji, this is going to be very sad to see you go.
Yeah, this is very sad for me to leave this community and also leave MERS, because I've been here for 9 months, I guess. I think so. And it's a really great time to work with everybody here. And I really learned a lot about, how to become a journalist and how to write news, and also improved my English a lot. Yep. And also it's sad for me to come back, not because the other reasons, but because there's a immigration process that I have to go through. So
yeah, right.
Yeah, it's kind of sad, but I'm excited to see my parents in Beijing, and yeah, that's it.
When's the last time you saw your parents?
Oh, that would be maybe 2 years ago.
Wow. No way.
Right, right.
You haven't seen your parents in 2 years.
Yeah, I came here in the September 2011, and I went back that winter because my apartment got broken in, and I was just sad, so I go back, and then I didn't come back until now, like after that. So it's been maybe 2 years that I didn't see my parents. So.
Oh, that's crazy. Yep. Well, I tried to fight with immigration for you to keep you here until at least the summer break, but I'm sorry, I failed.
Yeah, Angie. I appreciate everything that you and John did for me. So. And also the birthday things that Laurie did,
the chocolate cake.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that chocolate cake was amazing. Maybe she'll make it for my birthday too. That was pretty awesome. Yeah, we really appreciate it, Angie. It's going to be sad to have you go. Yeah. You've been really great. Your stories are great, and we just love having you around, so it's going to be sad. All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.